Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds, the associate producer of the Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review, we feature selections from this week's shows. This week's selections include special lockbox panels. The lockbox is open, so show your support by donating and helping WAMC deliver the information you need. You could pledge anytime online at WAMC.org. On Wednesday, October 2nd, the special lockbox panel focused on the vice presidential debate, and Joe was joined by Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics, Vera Acarius-Kelly, Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Robert Griffin, CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Mulligan, and political consultant Libby Post.
The debate last night was held, and it is being called by some a draw. It is being called by others that J.D. Vance did an excellent job. He had a smooth performance and really sailed through the debate, and really didn't have a whole lot of trouble answering questions. Now, whether answers were true or false, no. But did not stumble until we got to January 6th. And then there was Tim Walz's performance, and they did spar over immigration and abortion and foreign policy. And then eventually, as I mentioned, January 6th and Donald Trump's 2020 election loss. It is interesting to see the debate. I think that when you look at it, and while viewing it, I did think to myself, it's nice that it's cordial. I like that. Mm-hmm. I like that there's boring. It was a little boring, and mm-hmm. I kind of like that. I missed boring, and I enjoyed that. I didn't at any real point know what, and I will say this on both sides, always know what they were talking about, mm-hmm. in the sense of they were talking about very minutiae that they were referring to things that had been said online or in posts or in quotes and different things, and I didn't always know exactly what they were talking about. Now, I would argue, and I'm not certainly putting myself on any kind of pedestal, but I do this for a living to listen to these things, and I didn't know what they were talking about. I just wonder what the general public thought of people who were really listening and sort of doing a deep dive of trying to figure out what they were talking about. I'd like to go around the room, get general impressions from our panel, and begin with Libby Post.
Well, you know, anybody can be taught to be a slick, willy kind of debater, which is what we saw last night with J.D. Vance. The issue here really is that he made Trump seem palatable because he didn't dumb it down. He like couched it in popcorn and sugar, you know, and what is that stuff that when you go to the carnival? That you can get
cotton candy.
It is. Yeah.
I was thinking you were doing caramel corn.
Right. Well, he like, you know, swathed Donald Trump in cotton candy and tried to make the policies that they
I know, right?
Yeah. The policies, you know, palatable to the vast majority of Americans, and not as horrible as they actually are. You know, Walz has admitted he's not a good debater. We saw that last night. You know, that is what it is. Vance was pretty slick. But when it came down to, excuse me, but are you going to do one of the few things that's actually your job, which is to certify the election? Will you do that? Mm-hmm. He could not say yes or no. He could not say whether Trump is wrong in saying that he won the 2020 election. And Tim Walz was like incredulous around all of that, which was fine, and said, yeah, win or lose, I'll certify the election because that's my job. Mm-hmm. And so there was that. You know, all the stuff about immigration and, you know, people eating cats and dogs. You know, we didn't get into it too much, but Vance lied. That's the thing. He lied all the way through. And when they started to fact check him, I mean, I thought the sexism of the whole thing was unbelievable, right? You have these two women, they're accomplished, blah, blah, blah. You know, Norah O'Donnell's the anchor, right? And J.D. Vance just tried to run right over them, and they did the right thing. They turned off his mic because he wouldn't listen. He wouldn't respect the rules. And that's part and parcel to this ticket. They don't listen. They don't respect the rules. They think they can make things right the way they want to do it, and that's it.
So maybe I'm allowed to say something quickly on the issue of sexism, and then I'll pass it on to...
Well, first of all, you're more than allowed to do that.
Oh, okay. I just wanted to...
And second of all, couch that way, who the hell am I to say no?
And because, thank you, JD.
Right. And the anti-patriarchy people win 2 points.
Yeah.
So the floor is yours.
Well,
I just wanted to
say that what stood out to me as well was whenever Vance was talking about family-related issues, you know, children, and he so happily talked about his own children and his own wife at some point. All he ever mentioned were the challenges for his wife to take care of 3 children and work full time and take care of the household.
Amazing?
Like, it is not his responsibility as a father to do half of that.
Mm-hmm. The first word, by the way, was that she was beautiful.
Yes.
I mean, it is shocking how he tried to couch himself as so supportive of families when, in fact, he basically dumped all of the responsibilities for child rearing on his wife in the commentaries. I was like, are you serious? I mean, you are clearly sending a message that women belong in the household, manage everything, especially child rearing, while you're so proud of them when they also are accomplished attorneys and also do other things, right? Like the double burden for the woman is supposed to be like, you know, this is like celebrated
it's
now?
It's the Ring of Roses from the Kentucky
Holy
Derby.
Holy moly, I couldn't believe it. I nearly fell off my couch.
Let's go over to Bob Griffin for his thoughts. By the way, welcome Heather Mulligan to the discussion. Good morning. How are you?
I'm good.
It's really nice to see you. Thank you very much. Actually, Heather's not late. She told us she was going to be in this
That's
Thailand,
right.
And you got in right in it. So thank you very much. We're glad to have you here. We're going to hear from Bob, and then we'll may have to take a break, and then we'll come back and hear from everybody else. Go ahead.
So I have 7 takeaways from last night.
Oh, boy. Oh, well, okay, so maybe we'll get to you around quarter of 10.
So first, immigrants have godlike power to cause damage, so housing costs, storms, locusts, flies, farm costs, congressional incompetence. It's all the fault of immigrants. So if you have a bad day today and somebody calls you on it, say it's the immigrant's fault. Mansplaining is a major at Yale Law, but ethics and truth are not. while whitewashing history use barrels, not buckets. Policy is boring, but it's really important. But it's really hard to do in an hour and 45-minute debate. Like JD, I hope his kids were asleep last night so they didn't have to watch their dad lie through an hour and 45 minutes of a debate. The new strategy for the both campaigns. So on the Trump side, I think what they should say is Trump, stay home, shut up, and play golf, and just have JD on the circuit. And then for Harris, only send Walz to events with camouflage and corn dogs. And the one misstep that JD had last night, because I thought he was particularly smooth, but it was one misstep where he stepped off the Empire State Building. And I don't think the lack of admission about what January 6th was, his absolute refusal to say whether he would have done what Pence did was absolutely fatal.
I have to say that usually in those type of events, it's under 15 minutes before I'm screaming at the television. But I got almost to the end, and it was not until he said that on January 20th, there was a peaceful transfer of power, and that's when I started to scream.
He was much better. He was much smoother than Walz was, but that's just the type of people they are. I also think that Walz is just really nice and didn't call out the BS the way he should have.
What I found interesting is that Vance kept calling Walz Tim, and Walz kept calling Vance Senator Vance.
Yes.
And it was definitely a way for Vance to try to diminish who Walz is.
Although I did notice, which I didn't like visually, that Vance was always sort of looking, he must have been looking at the clock or something, like how much time is left, or he had this sort of, did you notice that?
The big clock right over the two moderators.
And so the way he looked, I always thought he's waiting exactly to figure out in his head what how he's going to respond to something, or if he's going to respond at all and get ready to go, you know, so that was visually interesting to me because his head, you could see that he was thinking on how to respond to certain ideas. So I found him slick. I found him unconvincing in terms of presenting a new self. He, you know, softened his edges. He said he never really meant to say that. He's reflected on things. He's become the, you know, the family man in a particular way, who's not going to, you know, challenge women the same way that the Republican Party right now does in terms of being more focused on family and child rearing. It was very interesting to see that development, but it was not believable to me.
I thought Walz was making crazy faces. Like, anytime Vance was talking, they showed
pain.
A side angle, and he looked, a couple times he looked mad. Sometimes, but he's taking notes, and you get this side view of him. And
like
I thought,
consternated.
I thought, you know, that just showed that this is not his comfort zone, right? He didn't want to have his face on the camera and get the full reaction to what Vance was saying, but I think it was a mistake to be sort of scowling.
We are having a look at what happened last night in the debate, and I unfortunately had to interrupt Heather as she was talking about what her takeaways were from the debate. And I guess we can go from the beginning, and I think let you go with this, Heather, but I think we sort of all in the room have agreed that Tim Walz was shaky, certainly at the beginning of the debate, seemed like he was struggling.
Yeah, I mean, I think first I should back up even further and say it was great. They were talking about policy. It was a real debate. I'm a policy nerd. I love that they actually got into some details and gave the framing for some of the things that are their differences, and that they were cordial and agreed on some things. I mean, it was a really, to me, civilized and very well orchestrated or run. I shouldn't say orchestrated. It makes it sound like they're puppets, but but it was. I thought that the moderators did a good job. My first thought when I turned it on was that I thought it was actually genius of Vance to wear the Barbie pink tie.
Because, I was wondering about that.
And he kind of coordinated with
Margaret Brennan.
Yeah, and so, but you know, I'm such a nerd about this stuff. I thought it was really good. I thought Walz really struggled and was not doing well in answering some pretty easy questions, which would have been softballs for him, quite a few. But he did kind of the second half, maybe about halfway through, kind of found his footing and, you know, really hit a very hard, I think, a big hit at the very end in his closing statement when he asked Vance, well, did Donald Trump win the last election?
Yeah, right.
You know, which, of course, Vance can't answer. But I thought it was fascinating. I get it that there's not a lot of people who are that interested. I don't think this moves anyone. But I was amazed at how adept Vance was at taking what, when Trump presents them, sound like really, really extreme policies, and making them sound sensible and logical and kind of putting a framing around them that will have some appeal to people. The people who are on the fence are in a smattering of counties in swing states. I doubt many of them were watching, and I doubt any of them are going to be voting based on who's the VP candidate. Although I do think Trump's age, it's important that Vance perform well.
But think about the chutzpah, though. I mean, to actually go on national TV, international TV, and say that Trump saved ACA, Obamacare.
And
I mean, and not even smirk when he lied about it. Yeah. I mean, just the there were so many times when I wish Walz had called him out. And, you know, a couple things. One is that yesterday's debate reminds us of how bad Trump's performance was and how good Harris was in the presidential level debate. And I don't want to lose sight of how good she performed in comparison.
And you know what's going to move the needle? The longshoreman strike and the situation in the Middle East. I now am convinced that those two issues may just decide this election.
Well, I mean, and if that's the case, I worry that that tilts it in favor of Trump.
Yes,
unfortunately. I mean, I think the one thing that Vance did very well was hitting the issues that they know are the concern issues, the economy, immigration. Did he overstate everything on those?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. You know, the world was a perfect, glorious place. There were daisies growing out of the ground. The world was at peace. People were, you know,
drinking
Pepsi in the fields and, you know, reading books in hammocks while Trump was president.
And apparently,
and now everything's fallen apart.
And apparently, you know, when Trump makes decisions, everything works out smoothly, like his son-in-law's real estate deal in Gaza. Look at how that worked out. You know, they set the stage for what's happening now in part of, you know, the levels of violence we see now.
I had a flashback to the Biden-Trump debate and last night, because I remember after that them saying that Trump was just going on lying and lying and lying, which of course, you know, was true. But there was they said, well, the moderators will not be fact-checking, but the candidates agreed that they would be doing the fact-checking. That was similar to what the candidates agreed to last night. And here again, you would think you would learn a lesson, but I don't think that Walz did at all an effective job in slapping back at those just outrageous, the most outrageous of the claims that were made. He seemed more befuddled than assured when it was thrown to him to try to coordinate a response.
You see, and I wonder how much that's cultural, though, Joe. I mean, my wife pointed out, she said, you know, that he's Midwestern polite, and she's Midwestern. She said, this is your, you know, well, bless your heart is a way of swearing at somebody. And you know, it's more Southern than
Southern.
Midwestern.
Yeah.
But he was incredibly polite. And Vance, for all of his issues, was also incredibly polite. Mm-hmm. I mean, they talked about where they were in agreement. They talked about where they were in disagreement. But at no point in time was it ever really acrimonious between the two of them, which doesn't make for good viewing. It certainly doesn't make for interesting TV.
I will say, I mean, I thought that Vance had an incredibly positive moment and showed a deep humanity when, you know, Walz mentioned that his son had witnessed a shooting, and Vance's response seemed not rehearsed. He would seem genuinely surprised, and he seemed like empathetic as a father would be empathetic.
Right.
And I thought that was, you know, really played well for him, for people who have doubts about his character. Not to say that I agree with, you know, all the other things he said, but I thought, you know, well played. I don't know. It seemed real to me. And I thought that was very, very interesting. And I don't think that happens when you have these, you know, completely, I don't know, orchestrated debates where everyone is hyper prepared. I think they're deadly focused on what's their next point. And this was a reaction that was not, you know, part of a script or anything.
That was Heather Mulligan on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, October 2nd. We'll be back with more after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review. On Thursday, October 3rd, Joe was joined by public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel, and Wall Street investment banker Mark Whitman.
Tanya Chutkan made public portions of a filing by prosecutors setting out their argument for why the case should go forward despite the Supreme Court's ruling on presidential immunity. So I think the quickest way to set this up is that this was originally shot down by the court and said that the president had the immunity after the Supreme Court decision. So then Jack Smith and the as special counsel goes back and they rework it, and then they once again file it for the charges to go against Donald Trump, and this is the unsealing of that, of what the arguments are going to be. When one of the lawyers, when told by an aide that Vice President Mike Pence was in peril as the rioting of the Capitol Hill escalated on January 6th, President Trump replied, "So what?" When one of his lawyers told him that his false claims that the election had been marred by widespread fraud would not hold up in court, Mr. Trump responded, "The details don't matter." On a flight with Mr. Trump and his family after the election, an Oval Office assistant heard Mr. Trump say, "It doesn't matter if you won or lost the election, you still have to fight like hell." Those accounts are among new evidence disclosed in a court filing made public on Wednesday, in which the special counsel investigating Trump made his case for why the former president is not immune from prosecution on federal charges of plotting to overturn the 2020 election. Going back to the reporter saying, "I don't see anything new here," and that goes back to much of this had been released in one form or the other during the January 6th hearings, and was through a series of witnesses and firsthand accounts was told to the special counsel at that point. So, but there still is some information in here that is important, and of course, interesting that it was released less than 35 days to go before the election. So, who would like to begin?
There is so much precedent for parsing out what are official acts, what are non-official acts, what are acts that have to do with your own, personal or private interests. Public officers' laws in states across the country have parsed this out for elected officials at the state level. In New York State, public officers' law has lots of case notes on this. It's not surprise. None of this is new information, first off, but how it's being presented to the court is evolving to respond to the Supreme Court's decision and parsing out what was under the umbrella of his presidential duties versus what he was doing for his own personal gain is a really important question, and not at all surprising that that's what, Jack is doing and has had to do here to refile. So I do think it'll be interesting to see how the argument evolves.
Right. I think that the key step was that what the courts said, I'm not the lawyer, but just restating, what the court said is it official business or is it personal business? And what the judge said is, okay, special counsel, special prosecutor, you come back and tell us what's in the personal business bucket and what's in the office business bucket. And that's basically what this does, pull everything out and separates it out. And I do think that what's new is that they basically brought the receipts, right? They brought the evidence of things that we knew, suspected to be true, but now there's more documentation. And the bottom line is that Trump knew. You know, he knew he didn't win. He had been told by top officials, close aides, family members over and over again that he didn't win, and privately acknowledged that he didn't win. Yet he has still pursued and continues to pursue this lie. And what strikes me is that he's all upset that this is coming out now. Well, it's coming out now because he has delayed and delayed and delayed and delayed.
This I'm sorry to interrupt, but this would have come out in January originally if he had not fought to keep it to be delayed.
Last January, and, yeah.
Yes.
Right, and
yes,
probably even sooner because he's delayed, delayed.
Yes.
And if he continues to say, you know, nothing to see here, well, if there's nothing to see here and he's not concerned about his innocence, why is he fighting so hard to not have this go to trial and you know, to move forward? But I also want to swing back to the vice presidential debate for a minute, because I think that the most consequential thing that came out of the debate, the vice presidential debate, was the last segment where J.D. Vance would not, perhaps because of fear of Trump's reaction, but would not acknowledge that Trump did not win the election. He would not acknowledge that he would have done what Pence did. And I think that that is absolutely disqualifying. How can you be President Trump? How can you be Vice President of this country when you can't even acknowledge the peaceful transfer of power? And there was all this talk about how well he did and he spoke so well, but there was also acknowledgement that he lied over and over again. And there's people are just, they're normalizing the lying because he lies in a nice tone and he, you know, speaks affirmatively. But lying has consequences. And, you know, not focusing on truth, not having a base of truth is a problem. It's a problem in this case. It's a problem in a lot of the other things he talks about. This is a really dangerous and costly pattern. And it's just not what we are as a country.
We're going to be going over to our Lockbox Central here in just about 2 minutes, but I want to hear from Mark, and then we'll if we don't get to all of your comments, we'll continue on the other side of the break.
I got a lot. And let me tell listeners, if your memory's like mine, you might want to get out a pen and pencil. I got something for you. You might want to take down, which I think is really insightful. The presidential debate, by the way, reminded me, or the vice presidential debate, reminded me of a country bumpkin trundling up to the porch of some custodial-like, slick-talking figure. And he and we almost got fooled, but as we were being led into the mega cottage, the country bumpkin asked one last question of this custodial figure. Said, you know, why are your teeth and your eyes so big? And just at the end, when he was going to take us in, Governor Walz asked the right question, and I think brought us all back to the sad reality of where we are.
Well, I think it was more than, I mean, health care. There were a whole series of questions that, anyway, I don't want to take
Your
time,
I'm not minimizing.
But he wasn't a bumpkin. I think, anyway, go ahead.
I'm not minimizing his overall performance, but I will say it did sort of snap you back to reality.
Right.
In a way that you hadn't been in the rest of the debate. And it drew the most important contrast. On this thing, I didn't see much new, although it's always amazing to me that there are still untold details of the depths of the depravity that Trump and his allies went to. It's a little, it's not surprising, but it's interesting. The one thing I would point listeners to is it's a op-ed piece in the Washington Post from April 26 by Alexandria Petri. I only ever read the name. I never pronounce it. It talks about a time traveler who goes back to the Constitutional Convention and says, I know you're almost going to sign it, but before you sign it, please put in the document that the president can't do crimes. And I'd encourage people to read it. It is one of those times when humor is actually the most insightful way to understand a problem that we face.
We had to cut you off there in the middle.
That's okay. Joe, with respect to the whole lot of the federal prosecutions of the former president, I have a sad thought, and a lot of folks like me were almost rabid about the fact that we need to prosecute this guy in order to further the case of justice in our country. And Teresa, just give me a second here, and a letter writers, wait till I'm done before you write. But if you look at it, in the end, the project has failed utterly. if you assume that Donald Trump is president. First of all, with every indictment, his popularity rose in the polls. And we are now at a coin flip as to whether or not he takes office. If he takes office, he will extinguish the federal prosecutions against him. So in prosecuting him, we aided the guy's attempt to return to the presidency. But also something else happened. The Supreme Court took such an aggressive eraser to the Constitution and the ideal that all people are equal under the Constitution that it tore a hole in the Constitution. And we yet do not know how big that hole is. They haven't defined that. They just said there's a hole here for the president and he can sneak some stuff through. So if you look at the project in total, we did not forward the cause of justice in this country by trying to prosecute Donald Trump. We actually, unfortunately, at least in the federal sense, have set it back.
I don't disagree with a thing you just said, other than the alternative would not have been to prosecute. And I don't see how we not could have not done that.
I disagree with most of it for the same reason. That, or you want to answer him first?
No. Go ahead. You can pile on.
Because you cannot not prosecute somebody for the mishandling of classified documents. You cannot look the other way at what happened on January 6th. What is the precedent you set? If you look the other way at inciting an insurrection that has talk about tearing into our democracy. And what about what does it say to the police officers, 140 police officers who were severely injured? What does it say to, you know, the fabric of our democracy? You can't look the other way. And I don't think we know yet what the outcome will be. One of the things that's clear is that the voters will have a clear say in the outcome and part of the outcome. But I think it was essential. And all of these details would not have come out. Now, yes, Donald Trump has done what he has done throughout his whole life, which is avoid being held accountable for his actions by throwing a lot of lawyers at the problem, a lot of money. In this case, he's been using money, low-dollar donors to his campaign are funding his defense, which I think is reprehensible also. But I'm hoping that in the end, that the American people send a real clear signal that an insurrection is not, you know, a president cannot be involved in an insurrection. A president, you're not presidential if you mishandle classified documents, and on and on and on.
Nick.
I mean, I don't think the Supreme Court had to make this ruling that to identify official acts and unofficial acts, because the court hearing the case itself could have distinguished between what was an official act and therefore not criminal, and what was not an official act and also criminal on its own. And so it does set this new precedent that it had no business setting. And as Mark describes, just kind of really impacts and has a devastating impact, I would even say, on the Constitution and the powers of the president. And it does seem that it was more intentionally a delay tactic than it was a necessary rule holding to have. And I think that's unfortunate, but at least at this point we are moving forward. But we won't have a resolution before the election, which is kind of the problem here.
But isn't that a reminder to voters that it matters who you, in many different ways, who you select as president, because that person is going to choose the Supreme Court?
Well, they know that, though. And many conservative voters that I know are supportive of the Trump administration, not because they like Trump, but because he is an effective judicial appointer, and
right,
that he has appointed these particular people to SCOTUS and hundreds of other bench appointments across the country, right? Like, that was the intent. The Second Amendment folks, the anti-choice folks, they did that intentionally, knowing that the result would be a conservative SCOTUS. So,
and I agree with you. A narrow but essential group of voters did that. But I think the broader group of voters hadn't thought so much about the importance of the Supreme Court, even though people have talked about it. And I think it's opened people's eyes in a profound way that how to a broader group of people about how important it is who is selecting the Supreme Court.
I'm talking about non-lawyer voters who are conservative friends.
I agree with you, non-voters. I'm sorry, I wasn't clear. I'm talking about there is a narrow group of voters, not lawyers, but a narrow group of conservative voters, the Federalist Society types, who are voting for the purposes of the court.
Yeah, I don't think that's true. I think the Second Amendment coalitions have used that narrative for a very long time. The anti-choice coalitions have used the narrative of court appointments for a very long time. And I think that the moneyed coalitions, the coalitions that wanted to overturn Chevron, have used the Second Amendment and anti-choice groups to support the bridge between general public voters and very powerful corporate money.
And I think
in order to get that kind of conservative court across the country.
That was Nick Rangel on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, October 3rd. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel The Week in Review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Friday, October 4th, the special lockbox panel focused on the state of journalism. And Joe was joined by semi-retired editor-at-large, columnist, editorial writer at the Times Union, Jay Jochnowitz, vice president for the editorial development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick, former Times Union associate editor, Mike Spain, and American journalist and newspaper editor that ran the newsrooms of the Miami Herald and the Boston Globe before being named executive editor of the Washington Post in 2013. His new book is Collision of Power, Marty Baron.
We are thrilled to welcome Marty Baron to the program. His new book is Collision of Power. It is out in paperback as of Tuesday. If you have not read the hardcover edition, the convenient paperback edition will be out on October 8th, and it is an absolute thrill to welcome Marty back to the program. Thank you so much for being with us, sir. What a delight.
Thanks for having me.
It's so nice to have you on the program. As you've been going around over the last year, talking about the book, talking about your career, talking about journalism, what has struck you about what interests people about the subject, about the state of journalism today, and how we as citizens and readers and consumers are interacting with it?
Well, I think the primary concern is whether journalism is fulfilling its role in our democracy. There's a lot of concern about the state of democracy in the country, and there are a lot of questions about how and whether media institutions are doing the job that's necessary, given the condition that we're in. And I think that's the primary concern that people have.
When you think of those primary concerns, how have those changed just since the time that you retired?
Well, we have a presidential election, and so I think people are very much focused on the choices that are the choice that's in front of them. And people are very uncertain about the direction of the country and very concerned about the direction of the country. And I think that comes from both ends of the political spectrum, but people have their own particular interests, of course, and particular perspective on what are appropriate public policies. And there's a lot of I think concern that democracy is in an exceptionally fragile state, and the question is how well will democracy survive? Is there adequate support among the general public for our democratic institutions? Is there adequate support for the role of the press, which is one of the pillars of democracy? And whether the press, what exactly should the press be doing to fulfill its role, and how well is it performing in this particular election? So, you know, I left after shortly after January 6, 2021. So I left at the end of February 2021. So that was just the beginning of the Biden administration. And so I think a lot has changed in that time. Obviously, the country is very much involved in, I mean, we're sort of entangled in one way or another in a couple of wars around the world, in Ukraine, Middle East. People have their concerns about the economy. We had a high rate of inflation, which has since subsequently moderated considerably to a low level at the moment. And you know, people are concerned about the border. People are concerned about the, as I said before, the fragile state of democracy. You know, people are concerned about issues of women's rights, particularly there's a large amount of support for the right to an abortion, and concern that the kinds of measures that are being taken in individual states are putting women in jeopardy, their own health in jeopardy. So there are a lot of concerns, and then the question is, how should the press respond to that?
Marty, I loved your book, and one of the reasons I loved it is it comes through loud and clear that you were a real working editor. I mean, you were on the ground, nuts and bolts kind of editor. So my question is, how would you tell a reporter, or what advice would you give a reporter covering the Trump campaign, specifically a Trump rally? How should they be covering those?
Sure. Well, first of all, thanks for those remarks. It's nice to know that people paid me for doing some actual work. thank you so much. And that money wasn't presumably wasted. Look, I mean, it's not just a matter of covering the rally itself. I mean, I certainly covering the rally, you know, I mean, it depends on what happens at the rally. There's been a lot of debate lately over if Trump is speaking incoherently, which does happen with some frequency, how you should report on that. And I certainly think that if he's not making any sense, then you should make that clear and not try to make what is incoherent coherent. Some people have used the term sane washing. I don't particularly like that term because it's not a matter of sanity. It's a matter of coherence. But overall, in terms of the campaign itself, I mean, I think that it's important that we cover the kinds of policies that each of the candidates intends to implement, who they intend to implement them with, who they would have as part of their administration, how they would go about implementing that, given the existing laws in this country and the Constitution that we have. And what kind of impact would those policies have on the lives of ordinary people? Those are the things that I think we should focus on most. Now, of course, an election, people bemoan that there's a lot of focus on the horse race, but an election is a horse race. The reason that we're talking about Kamala Harris as a candidate, the reason that she is the nominee for the Democratic Party is because there was such concern within the Democratic Party about how Joe Biden would fare in that horse race. So you can't ignore the horse race. It's very important. But I think that we can cover the substantive issues at the same time. We can walk and chew gum at the same time. We can cover the policy matters as well as the horse race. And I think the policy matters are by far the most important. And we ought to be looking at, you asked about Trump in particular, so we ought to be looking at what his policies are. And the reality is that the kinds of policies that he has spoken openly about, he's not hiding anything, the kinds of policies that he has spoken openly about are exactly the kinds of policies that we've seen in other countries that have moved in an authoritarian direction. And you know, you talk about bringing treason charges against your perceived political enemies, including people who worked in his own administration. He talks about bringing treason charges against some of the networks and withdrawing their licenses, their ability to operate simply because their coverage is not to his liking. He has actually spoken about termination of the Constitution because of his assertion, entirely false, by the way, that the 2020 election was fraudulent. So, you know, a whole range of, he's talked about using the military to suppress protests, entirely legitimate protests for that matter. So those are the kinds of measures that we have seen in other countries that have moved in an authoritarian direction. And I think it's important to point that out. It's not a matter of opinion. It's just a matter of fact.
Just a side question to that, a follow-up of how you feel. There was an article in the New York Times about a week ago about how Senator Vance, while on the trail, will often do news conferences in front of the audience at rallies and will use reporters as props. And then turning on the reporters in real time and talking about how awful the press is and so forth. To going to Judy's question, I mean, how much should your reporter be a part of that nonsense?
Well, I don't think we should be. I don't think we should be used as props for any candidate. You know, they speak against the press, but, you know, somebody like J.D. Vance, he's actually doing quite a few interviews, both with friendly media and other media that I think is more independent. You look, I mean, we're a convenient enemy. We get blamed for everything. We get blamed by the Democrat. We get blamed for everything. We get blamed for, for being too harsh on Trump. We get blamed for being too easy on Trump. We get blamed for being too harsh on Joe Biden. We get blamed for being too easy on Joe Biden. We get blamed for just about everything. And it's so convenient for politicians to point to the press. We're just the convenient enemy. And look, I mean, even during the debate with Tim Walz, when J.D. Vance was asked about some of the really harsh things that he has said about Donald Trump in the past, about his economic policies having been a failure, what he said about, compared Donald Trump to Hitler. I mean, that's all on the record. He basically said, well, I believed what I read in the media. Now, here's a guy who went to an Ivy League school, who's really smart and discerning, presumably, and the idea that somehow he's been duped by the media is just not credible. He said what he believed at the time, and he may have changed his opinion, or he just may have changed what he has to say publicly to get elected. But to sort of blame the media for his own beliefs when he was, he's a guy, as I said, who went to an Ivy League school, really smart. He worked in the investment industry as a venture capitalist. He wrote a book that was highly successful, best-selling book. The idea that he can't think for himself is just preposterous.
Jay Jochnowitz.
Yeah, I think we probably look at this from the same point of view, and I think everybody in this room probably does too, from except for Joe, who's radio, but we look at it from a print point of view. And I was struck this morning by a New York Times headline, and it was a very short article. Former President Trump held a rally in Michigan that was notable mainly for his continued false statements. And I thought, you know, that's exactly what you need to do, just a short and sweet editorial that, you know, says here's what he did. Yes, not editorial. I'm sorry. It's
headline.
A news story and headline that, covers it. I'm curious, though, since you're retired, you probably have a little more time to watch TV. How the network and cable news is handling this, which I think is what the all the soul searching was about, that he was so entertaining to watch. And I said this back in 2016, and it grated on my wife when I said, he is magical. There is something about him that is very charismatic and very compelling to watch. Do you think they're doing a better job on TV of presenting a of not whatever mistake we made, we as the media industry made in 2016, do you think we've fixed that?
Well, first of all, I don't really watch much TV. Part of it is because, well, first of all, it takes a lot of time. And secondly, I don't really like what I see on a lot of particularly cable television. Mm-hmm. And I do think that there have been some significant, and also I think that cable television has just become, you know, too partisan in its approach. And mm-hmm. and particularly some individual networks, and both on the right and the left. And so I, but I do think there were some significant mistakes made at the beginning. And one, for example, was CNN. Well before any primary was held, CNN gave a full interview to Donald Trump, and as usual, he steamrolled the interviewer. And the only reason that CNN did that interview was to try to demonstrate to the world, to the American public, that it was open to Republicans. And so that's a marketing reason for having an interview. It's not a journalistic reason for having an interview. Mm-hmm. They declared him essentially to be the front runner before a single primary had been held. And I thought that was highly premature. And as I said, not done for journalistic reasons. The same thing with NBC when they had a new host for Meet the Press. They wanted to promote their new host. So, of course, what do? You ask Donald Trump for an interview, and he happily accepted. And once again, he largely steamrolled the interviewer. And no primary had been held. There was no particular reason for them to give him an hour. And they did. And I think that those sorts of things make no sense. I think we need to stick to our journalistic purpose. We shouldn't be doing things strictly for marketing reasons, particularly when it involves the presidency of the United States, which is, by the way, the single most powerful position in the entire world. Mm-hmm. Those were big mistakes, and they were akin to what happened back in 2015 and 2016 when Trump was first running, when CNN and Fox were running Trump's rallies from beginning to end, without any commentary, without any contradiction, without letting him say whatever he wanted, much of it false, much of it very, very incendiary. And basically that's kind of in-kind advertising to a candidate's campaign. So I was concerned about that. I do think that, as you mentioned, that I think people are being more direct. I think the press overall, including cable outlets, are being more direct about what's false. Every once in a while, Fox will even point that out, which is an exception, not the rule for Fox, sadly. And I think that's a good thing, is that we should point out what he's saying when he's saying something false and document why it's false. Whether that makes it any difference with the American public is another matter. We live in a highly polarized society. We're largely tribal at this point. Most people have already decided who they're going to vote for. Probably only a single-digit percentage is undecided, and so these kinds of this kind of fact-checking probably doesn't have any real-world impact. But I think it's important for the historical record and for the fulfillment of our own mission that we continue to do that.
That was Marty Baron on the Roundtable panel on Friday, October 4th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at WAMC.org/roundtable. Now I will be sending it over to Joe Donahue and Sarah LeDuc, who will be asking for your help to support our station.
Welcome to the lockbox portion of your Saturday morning program.
That's right. This is at the tail end here of the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. We would like to remind you that WAMC is about to have a fun drive. The Full Tilt whole shebang will begin at 6 a.m. on October 14th, but you can donate any time before then to help us fill the lockbox.
So we have been doing these special panels all week, and we have been talking during the lockbox. But one of the ideas that we've been doing, and the reason that we have this very show today, is that we've been doing real roundtable panels.
Yes,
and
indeed.
That's how we can have a look at what we did over the week, a week in review, because we did the programs, and we've been able to do that because you've been supporting us. So to do that, we have to keep supporting us. Yes. And all you have to do is go to WAMC.org, WAMC.org, do it online. If you haven't heard us during the week and you're hearing us on the weekend, well, now's a really good time to go to a device, WAMC.org, and help out in any way you can to keep all of this programming going that you need so desperately, that I think we all need so desperately, especially as we get ready for a major election.
Of an incredibly important, monumental election that has a lot of people, you know, diving to their news sources saying, what do I need to know? How can I be best informed? What is going on out there in the region, in the country, in the world? And that's what WAMC is here to help provide to you. We want to bring you news, arts, entertainment, facts, and information, and we can't do that truly without your support. Please go to WAMC.org and give as much as you can. Again, we like to reiterate that we don't want anybody to go into debt to support the station, but whatever you can give, we are so appreciative of, and you can pledge any amount, anytime at WAMC.org.
You know what you can do? When you go to WAMC.org, you'll go on and you'll see the thermometer. It'll tell you how much we have in and how much we have to go. And while as we record this, do I know exactly how much we have to go? No. Do I know that it's a lot? Yes.
It's less than 1 million.
It's less than a million, but it's not much less than a million. And so we have a long way to go. But the point is, whatever you can do right now is less than we're going to have to do during next week, during Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday pitching, both during the roundtable and at other times during the day. So if you do what you can do right now, well, first of all, it's off your conscience. Oh, I don't have to worry about it. And second of all, you know, we need it.
We do need it. The station can't survive without the support of our listeners. There's no paywall to access the information. You can flip on your radio or stream us anytime, and that doesn't cost anything. You can listen and share things from our website, WAMC.org, and that doesn't cost anything, but it does cost money to keep the station running. Nobody's getting rich working here, but we are passionate about what we do, and the station can't stay on the air without support of our listeners. So many of you have shown up already. We're incredibly grateful. We're always really buoyed and appreciative at the end of a fun drive that so many people show up, give what they can, and help us reach our goal. And we're just in that period right now, asking you to please show up for us if you believe in WAMC, if you believe in the mission, if you listen often. Nobody probably likes every program on the station. It does seem like some people do and listen all day long. But whatever you do like, if it's valuable to you, please give what you can at WAMC.org.
It's a great way to do it. I mean, to find that one thing that you just can't live without, that one thing that you turn the dial on for to hear. And it, I mean, maybe you have, as Sarah mentioned, maybe you have a list of 20 things. But if you have that one thing, just pitch for that and say, this is what this is worth to me, whether it's the time tones or a temperature break or a Ray Graph or Sarah or Vox Pop
or the round table.
Thank you. or whatever you find to be useful. I like Steve Inskeep. Great. That the one thing that you find that you want to preserve and that you want to make sure is around for the future, go and support that. And that's a really easy way to do it. And even easier is you set the goal. You set what it is that you think it's worth to you. And we will certainly be able to put that to good use and to help preserve this radio station and to keep us going during really tough times.
WAMC.org is the best way to pledge over the weekend. We will leave you now to the rest of your Saturday and Sunday, and we'll be back asking for more and giving you more excellent content on Monday morning. Have a good weekend, Joe.
Enjoy the weekend.
This has been this week's Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Thank you for listening.